Cape Cod is one of three major hotspots for marine mammal strandings worldwide. Each winter, dozens of dolphins and small whales wash up on the shores of Cape Cod Bay. Even by Cape Cod standards, though, 2012 was a record-breaking year. 217 common dolphins stranded in just a four-month period. It was the largest mass stranding in the Northeast in 20 years of record-keeping. Such mass strandings are magnets for public sympathy and exhausting both physically and emotionally for those who respond. They're also a major resource for scientists who study marine mammals. Here to discuss the science of strandings is Katie Moore. She's manager of marine mammal rescue and research at IFAW, the International Fund for Animal Welfare, headquartered here in Yarmouth. She previously led the Cape Cod Stranding Network from its inception in 1998 until it merged with IFAW in 2007. And before that, she worked with the National Marine Fisheries Service. Her expertise on preventing and responding to marine mammal strandings has also been called into action around the world, from Argentina to Madagascar. Katie, welcome. I've heard your name for years. It's a pleasure to finally meet you.
Thank you. Good morning.
And as always, we welcome you to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 866-999-4626, email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org, or find us on Twitter. Now, Katie, I have to ask, how did you get started in this line of work? Are you one of those people who has just been in love with dolphins for as long as you can remember?
No, that's not me. I fell into it by accident, really. I had a wonderful roommate when I was in college, in graduate school, actually, who saw an ad in the paper one day. We were at Duke University down in North Carolina, and the ad was to volunteer to do a dolphin count, basically doing an assessment of how many animals you count or are along the coastline in a certain period of time. And they do it up and down the coast with volunteers at the same time every day. And the folks that ran that actually were the folks who ran the Stranding Network there. And that was the beginning of a volunteering relationship that then led to a career choice.
So what had you thought you were going to be doing instead?
Coastal environmental management. I had gone down there. I figured I would come back and save the coastline.
Well, that's... I guess you found your calling. Obviously, you've been doing this for a number of years. Let's get an update. The stranding season, typically, for at least for dolphins and small whales, is usually from about December to April, right?
Yes.
And so we're kind of midway this year. Where do we stand? It seems like it's been kind of a quiet year. At least there hasn't been any major events that have drawn a lot of public attention.
Yes. Knock on wood, since we're a superstitious bunch. It's very different from last year. We have only a handful of strandings so far in this calendar year. And even through December, it was remarkably different from last year. Last year, in 2012, we started up January 12th was the first stranding of that common dolphin event that lasted for so long. And this year, so far, so good. It's a very, very different year. So we're taking advantage of the opportunity to try and collate some of the data and put things together.
So last year, let's remind folks, it started on January 12th. By, I believe, the first day of February, there had already been over 100 common dolphins that had stranded. I mean, that's, you know, sometimes 6-8 dolphins were washing up in a day. How do you handle that kind of situation?
It was different than anything we've ever handled before, definitely. And you take things one day at a time, and certainly the first day was one animal, and then 2 days later we had 13 animals in one day. And you know, at first, we're used to having mass strandings. This is Cape Cod. It's one of those strange phenomena that happen here, and so we weren't surprised to have them, but it kept going and going. So what got difficult is when you hit week two or week three and you realize, wow, we're having strandings every single day, live and dead animals. And that was very different than any scenario we had ever seen. And this lasted, total event, for over 80 days.
So what is an average year on Cape Cod?
Average is, you know, 250 total strandings for a year. And that's dolphins, whales, seals, porpoises. And we had 375 last year. So it was a remarkable year.
I mean, that's still 250 animals is still a lot of animals. There's only 365 days in the year. So, I mean, you're talking 2 out of every 3 days, kind of on average, you're dealing with a stranding.
Yes. And that doesn't even include, you know, we get a lot of reports of like seals that are resting on beaches and things like that, that, you know, they're not considered stranded. So we monitor them and we have volunteers who go out and do a quick health assessment from a distance just to make sure they're doing okay. But so there's a lot of effort that goes on that doesn't even really get recorded in that respect.
So why is Cape Cod such a hotspot? Do we know that?
Definitively, that's a really difficult thing to say, but there are a lot of factors that we have in common with some of the other hotspots in the world that are primarily in Australia and New Zealand. And one of the things is just kind of the physical aspects of the Cape. We are this arm that sticks out into the ocean, and we have this beautiful bay. I mean, Cape Cod Bay is where we see most of the strandings. They happen within the bay and most often within Wellfleet. So that's kind of the hook within the hook if you look at a map. And we have these very gently sloping beaches. Anybody who, you know, knows that they, if you want to go swimming out in Brewster at low tide, you're going to have a walk before you can get deep enough water to swim in. And so these aspects of having these long, gently sloping beaches and the hook that sticks out in the ocean are very similar to what we see in areas that experience mass strandings to the same level in other countries.
So there are two other kind of hot spots, right? New Zealand is one, and the third is
Australia.
Is Australia, and they have the same sort of topography in those regions?
They do, and there have been some studies from some folks that have been doing their graduate work there looking at both those aspects and also sediment size and how that may impact the animal's ability to echolocate in shallow water.
Oh, very interesting. So is it smaller or is it larger? It's
the smaller sediment size can be really difficult. And if you look at, take Wellfleet, for example, and you look at that really fine, silty sediment that they have there, that may be part of why those animals have a harder time getting out of those areas.
So when we're talking about strandings happening, this sounds almost like it's just a matter of becoming confused. Does illness or a problem on the part of the animals have anything to do with it? Or is it literally just that they kind of get into these places that are confusing for them?
I think it depends on the situation. When we have a single animal that comes ashore, especially a single dolphin or porpoise or especially a large whale, there's usually something wrong. What we found when we do necropsies or autopsies on animals that have died, when we look at single animals, they more often have some kind of disease process or injury or something that caused them to strand. But when we take instances of mass strandings where you have a group of animals that come ashore, The necropsies on animals that have mass stranded generally reveal no real significant findings. There's no illness, no significant lesions other than those that came from the act of stranding itself. So these are otherwise healthy animals in most cases. So we think that there's something else going on there that gets them into the situation that they just can't get out of.
So with the small whales and the dolphins, it's primarily this winter December to April period when they're stranding. Why is it that season in particular? Is that just when they're in our waters?
It's obviously when they're coming into the bay more and they're coming into the shallows more. What's driving them, most likely I would guess would be prey and foraging. Something's driving them into these areas closer to shore. But the interesting thing is that when we have animals that have mass stranded, there's never anything in their stomach. Almost never. That's almost completely across the board. So it's a really interesting finding in the process because a lot of people say, oh, I saw them feeding, but there's no evidence of that when we look in their stomachs.
Could it be that the ones that are stranding are just extra hungry and going that extra mile to try to find some food and get themselves into trouble?
You know, it's a really difficult thing to say. I think that sometimes these animals, you know, get into these areas and we watch them. When we get early warning and we know that they're in an area and we're able to get out on the water and actually see them and observe them swimming and look at behaviors, they're acting like normal dolphins. You know, they're swimming, they're feeding, at least it looks like they're feeding, but they're also just milling around and moving and doing things very normally. They don't appear ill or injured or disoriented, so...
My guest is Katie Moore of the International Fund for Animal Welfare. If you have questions or comments for Katie, you can call us at 866-999-4626. You can email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org, or you can find us on Twitter at Living Lab Radio. So you talked a little bit ago about finding these animals when they're still out on the water, potentially getting into a situation where they might be in trouble. And I know you've worked particularly hard on methods to prevent mass strandings. How do you prevent this?
Well, one of the things that we do, and we call it herding, and basically we look at animals. These are very social animals. That's another aspect of why they mass strand, is the social bonds that these animals have. And we try to use that when we're herding them. And it's much like a cowboy would herd cattle. We put our boats in the water and try and get between the animals and the beach and slowly move them out toward deeper water. It works really well in areas like out in Wellfleet in the Herring River, more contained areas. When it's an open-facing beach, it can be really difficult. But we try to use the animal's own instinct to stay together to try and encourage them out. What we do to help with that is we use pingers or acoustic deterrents. And pingers are little devices. They're about the size of a soda can. And they were developed to reduce the bycatch of marine mammals in fishing nets. So they emit a high-frequency pinging noise that doesn't hurt the animals but is annoying to them. And so we try to drop those into the water. They have a saltwater switch, so they turn on when we put them in the water. And they make this high-frequency noise that we can then use to hopefully as a sound barrier to actually move those animals out and encourage them in the direction we want them to go. It meets with mixed success depending on the size of the group. The more animals there are, the better they tend to respond, and also by species, more successful with white-sided dolphins than with the common dolphins.
So do we have any idea why the two species respond differently? Is it a different in their innate hearing abilities, or is it just more in their response to the sound?
I think it's more in the response. Their hearing ranges are very, very similar, so I wouldn't expect that to be the difference. It may just be more a behavioral thing for them.
Now, when these animals do end up on the beach, some of them wash up dead, some of them wash up alive. Take us kind of through the response when you find, first of all, a live animal on the beach. What do you actually do with that animal?
When we get a report of a live animal on the beach, we're fortunate. We have 6 staff members right now, but we have almost 250 volunteers across the Cape and South Coast that respond in their hometowns and across the region when we need them. And so the first thing we'll do is deploy volunteers that are trained to go out and start to gather information while we're en route. And they do things like providing supportive care for those animals. And that can mean riding them if they're on their side to help them breathe a little bit better. And they relay information to us. How many animals are there? What species? How big are they? What condition are they in? Does it look like there's anything wrong? So that we can be ready to go as we get on scene. And what we like to do then is get them onto stretchers. We have specially designed stretchers that allow their pectoral flippers to hang through. And we get them up into our trailer. We have 2 nicely outfitted transport trailers now. Years ago, these were open flatbed trailers, and you can imagine how hard that can be in January to transport animals in an open flatbed. Now we have beautiful enclosed trailers, and it's actually a mobile lab unit. So we have the ability to actually draw blood and analyze blood samples in the trailer to try and get a better sense of what might be going on with the animals and if there's any illness apparent.
So you do, once you get there, you do a fair bit of diagnostic testing and also, I guess, some samples and that kind of sort of thing that would be for scientific research. So what all do you, once you get them in your mobile lab unit, you're taking blood, but are there other tests that you're running?
Yes. Once they're in the unit, everything that we do is really, the data that we're collecting are concurrent or part of our health assessments. So it's part of the diagnostics that we're doing. There's no pure research really, but we're doing the blood sampling. We're taking swabs of things like the blowhole and in the mouth and taking measurements of both the total length and different parts of the animal. We had actually some interesting findings with that this past year in some variations between different animals. We're also doing a lot of diagnostics, doing testing hearing in animals as well. And so we also have the opportunity to ultrasound animals and looking for pregnancy and looking at their blubber thickness using an ultrasound. So it's a non-invasive method to actually tell what their body condition really is. And we've had some opportunity to take the samples that we have over this past year with some grant funding to really send out. We sent out 25 sets of full samples. So we were testing for all kinds of viruses like Triple E and West Nile and influenza and things like that to see what might be affecting the animals.
Now, you do all of this diagnostic testing, and then the goal is to try to release these animals again. And in the past 10 or 15 years while you guys have been doing this, the release rate and the successful release rate has really just increased dramatically from what, about 14% to almost 60%. And last year with the common dolphin stranding, you were saying it was almost 75% that were released successfully. So how do you account for that increase? What has changed?
I think several things have changed for us. A lot of it is a change in mentality. We originally believed that, especially with mass stranded animals, there must be something wrong. And so we were assuming the worst. And basically, a lot of animals didn't survive, I think, because we didn't think they would. And we euthanized a lot of animals thinking that that was the most humane thing to do. But in looking back at all the records, both prior to our work and then the work that we were doing from necropsy, and seeing that most of the animals were otherwise healthy, we really changed our approach. And we were able to institute some really good supportive care. So volunteers who are now, some of whom have been doing this for about 15 years with us, who are out there, they know what to do to give supportive care to right the animal. We stay very calm. We move very quickly. And we have the ability to do such thorough health assessments that we can look at an animal, and most of the time, we're not always 100% correct because there's still a lot we don't understand, but we're better at assessing what animals can be released. We don't want to put an unhealthy animal back out there. That would be cruel. But taking a healthy animal and being able to put it back out there is a great thing. And so I think it's that supportive care and some really good diagnostics and moving very, very quickly that helps.
Joel is giving us a call from Brewster. What's on your mind, Joel?
Hi. The Cape is often referred to as a southern migration trap for animals because of its shape and everything. These animals are pretty bright. And they get around, the large whales and the smaller ones, and I was curious, is there any evidence that any of them have discovered the canal and used it? And if so, these animals seem to be able to swap information even. I find it kind of interesting that in the last almost 100 years that canal has existed, that they haven't found it to be a highway to the south
side. Let's see here, Joel. Have we seen dolphins or whales moving through the canal? Do we know if they do use it?
They do use it, but I would agree that it's infrequent. We have had even right whales that have moved through the canal that folks have seen. The good thing is there's always people on the canal. So if something's moving through it, we're going to get a report usually, unless they're doing it in the dead of night in the dark. Just this last season, when we were so busy, we did have one report of a large group of common dolphins moving through the canal and into Cape Cod Bay. It's really infrequent to see animals in Buzzards Bay. So I think that's why we don't get a lot of reports on that end. But we did have reports of a large group coming in, and we did subsequently have some strandings within days of that. So we were wondering if it was the same group.
Great question, Joel. If you have a question for Katie Moore of the International Fund for Animal Welfare, you can reach us at 866-999-4626 or email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org. Now, obviously, your goal with most of these stranded animals is, as you said, to assess their health, if they're healthy enough, get them back out there and release them. But some of them, whether they come in sick or they sustain injuries, that they're either dead when they strand or you guys deem them unfit to be released. How do you make that? What's the criterion? How do you make that decision that you need to euthanize an animal?
It's an incredibly difficult decision. None of us likes having to do that, but at the same time, we know that it's our responsibility to do whatever is most humane for each individual animal. The process, the good thing is that we have enough staff members now and we have a lot of experience, so we're able to kind of confer on each case and really determine. It's kind of a last resort thing if we really think an animal isn't going to make it. We've started really to try to find that line. One of the difficult things for us is that there's still so little known about assessing wild dolphin health in terms of what is normal. Well, we draw their blood and we look at all the results that we get, but determining what really the normal levels are for a wild population, much of the data we have are from animals in rehabilitation or in captivity, and that's a little bit different. So it's difficult for us to assess. And so we've had to, you know, really work at determining what those predictive factors are. And it is a really difficult process to come to that conclusion and have to decide to do that. But when an animal isn't healthy enough, whether it's apparently ill or very, very thin, poor body condition, there are certain factors that come into play. Sometimes it's a very much a behavioral assessment where an animal is very clearly dying when we're handling it, and it's a matter of humanely euthanizing it so it doesn't suffer anymore.
Now, once an animal is dead, though, it actually becomes a major resource for science because, of course, these animals are all protected species. You can't just go out and kill a dolphin to dissect it and learn what's going on in its body. So how much of dolphin or whale research actually depends on these strandings to get tissue samples or to get access to these animals?
I think that a lot of researchers recently and over time have really realized the value of strandings even more so than before. Historically, all of the data we have originated from either whaling days or from stranded animals. And so we look at it as our responsibility not only to do our research to better understand what's going on with the populations here and how we can better serve them and how we can help to save more animals, but to also be a conduit for other researchers to get really critical samples to understanding not only the individual animals, but the habitat they're living in. I mean, these guys can be sentinels for what's going on in the ocean. And so I think it's an important resource for us from a scientific standpoint, but also then building that back into conservation and management measures so that we're doing the right thing in a big picture way.
So what is your relationship between IFAW and the rescue team and then the scientists who might want tissue samples or bone samples, whatever it is that would come from these animals? Are you guys performing the necropsies or are you handing over bodies or tissue samples to other researchers? What's that interplay there?
We do the necropsies. We have one staff member who is dedicated as a necropsy coordinator, though she does everything. We all have to multitask. So the live animals obviously come first, but when we have a dead animal that's up, we have volunteers and our staff member that focus on sampling. We also have Dr. Michael Moore, who's a Woods Hole researcher, but is also our veterinarian of record. And so he's there to also assist with that process. And we try to farm out as many samples as we can. And we also invite those folks, especially with so many local scientists, it's great to get them to actually come into the lab and be a part of the process. It helps us to get the job done, but it's also great to be able to share that experience as well.
Now, of course, doing a necropsy on a dead whale, a dead dolphin, is not necessarily a pleasant task. The smell alone can be quite overwhelming, as some Cape Cod residents have found out.
A dead whale appeared on the beach, and we thought it looked interesting because there were a group of people obviously conducting an autopsy, if that's the term. And so we decided we'd go down and see what they were determining. We got within about 40, 50 feet of it, and the smell was such that we retreated back to exactly where we're standing now. It was atrocious.
Tom Burns, visiting Coast Guard Beach. You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
Now, Katie, you've been literally hip, waist deep inside of whales, basically, to do these autopsies, the necropsies of these animals. Do you have volunteers involved in this as well? And how do they handle the kind of gruesome aspect of this?
We do have volunteers that work with every aspect of it. And I will say the large whale is the extreme case. They smell worse than anything, and obviously just size and mass is a very different experience to take it apart. But we have volunteers who do whale necropsies with us as well. I will say that there are folks who don't choose to participate in that part of it. They would prefer to do the live animal response, and that necropsy does take a certain fortitude to be a part of.
Well, and talk about that transition from, in some cases, you are trying to rescue an animal, you come to the realization that you can't rescue the animal, you need to euthanize it, and then once it's euthanized, you're going to be doing the autopsy. That's got to be an incredible emotional toll. These are animals that are obviously intelligent, that you can really develop a bond with. How do you handle the emotions of that whole situation?
I think as staff members, we keep a certain objectivity about it, and we look at it, we're very much doing a job, and that sounds cold, but it's not that there's no emotion, it's just that we put it aside while we're doing the job to do that, the whole spectrum of work from transitioning to providing care to having to euthanize an animal, which I think is actually harder than the necropsy part of it, because that's, you know, deciding to take a life is a very difficult thing, even when you know it's the most humane thing to do, and you do it in a humane way. There's a lot of responsibility that goes with that.
Not to be morbid, but how do you do it?
The same way your veterinarian would do. It's chemical euthanasia. So basically, we just put them to sleep. And so it's generally a very quiet process, but not always. Sometimes these animals don't respond the way that you think they would, and they have kind of an excited phase. So it's sometimes a difficult process as well. But, you know, the volunteers don't often transition to do both. They don't often do the live care of an animal and then go do the necropsy. The staff members end up having to do that, but volunteers not usually.
After a season like last year where you had this just incredibly intense, over 100 days, 200 animals, and most of them you were able to release, but still a fair number that had to be either euthanized or and then necropsied. And there was a blog post actually on the IFAW website just this past week. And the person writing it said, I'm almost dreading this season. I'm still processing not only the data, as you mentioned earlier, they're still processing data and, you know, from those necropsies, but still processing the emotions from that. Do you guys have any, I guess, support system for the people that are working on this that you are trying to process all the emotions of these major stranding events?
I think we rely on each other really heavily, and even the volunteer group. We do a couple of group events during the year just to bring folks together, especially after that season, to have a chance to kind of decompress and talk about things. And we do kind of the analytical, you know, analysis of what we did, but then we also kind of sit down and sometimes in reality, it's sitting down over a few beers to try and decompress about about the emotions and the exhaustion. And part of it was just that it went on and on and on and on. And at one point we said, you know, what if this doesn't stop? What if this is the new normal? What if we just have strandings like this all the time? And there was silence when we said that, because we actually didn't know at that point. It had been so many days. And it was really overwhelming. And then when it finally stopped, I think this year, now that we've come back and we're in what should be our busy season, I personally am more anxious because I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm waiting for it to start. So I feel like I have to hurry up and get everything done so we're ready. And I think the team's been the same way. We're just trying to get everything in order. But we do, you know, we rely on each other. We crack a lot of jokes when we're back at the warehouse cleaning all of our gear after a big event. You know, it's cold, it's late, you know, it's 1 o'clock in the morning and you're cleaning gear and you have to be able to laugh a little bit about the silly things so that you can kind of release some of the tension of the day.
So it's been almost a year. You know, a year ago, we were right in the midst of this. Are we starting to see kind of publications results from science come out from last year's strandings? What's the cycle on seeing a result from some of the necropsies and the sampling that you do?
You know, it's really interesting for us. As you said, we started in 1998 as the Cape Cod Stranding Network, and we've spent a long time gathering data. And it's just, I would say, in the last couple of years that we've really started to have a data set that's worthy of analysis. And after this past season, the season itself, just the volume of animals that we had, gave us an opportunity to really get a bigger picture of what's going on with these species. So we actually do have a couple of publications of our own that are being reviewed right now by the authors for a final review. And we have several publications with other researchers that hopefully will be coming out within the next year. I mean, it takes a little bit of a process to get it through review and things like that. But the good thing is I feel like we're becoming more productive and we have more to share because we've been doing so much more science with these animals, live and dead.
So what is some of the stuff that has come from your, what sorts of findings? Can you give us one example?
Sure. Actually, the two publications that we're working on are kind of linked, and it's bringing together our satellite tagging program, so looking at post-release monitoring to kind of ensure that we're doing the right thing for these animals and that we're choosing the right animals to get out there. And the other is comparing some of our physical and health assessment parameters with the tagging data to actually bring that together to say, okay, what are the most predictive diagnostics that we're doing? So how can we better identify these animals to ensure survival when they go out there?
Very interesting stuff. Katie Moore is Manager of Marine Mammal Rescue and Research at the International Fund for Animal Welfare. Katie, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Living Lab on the Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.